Welcome to another episode of Spanish History 101, brought to you by Brian Spaindomain. In the last episode, we attempted to sum up what was happening in Spain in the 13th century, in the different kingdoms, as well as in the territories controlled by the Muslims. If you recall, after losing the Battle of Navas de Tolosa in 1212, the Moors sort of had to retreat. They lost most of their land. And under the Nasrid dynasty, are relegated mainly to a southern nook of the peninsula, and it becomes known as the Emirate, or the Kingdom of Granada. There they would stay for another 280 years, more or less, protected by the natural boundary of the Sierra Nevada mountains to the north, and by the fact that Castile was more than happy to get money from them every year. These payments were known as partias, or tributes, and they essentially turned the emirate into a vassal kingdom. We also looked at the intellectual and cultural feats achieved by the monarchs of Castile, but we also brought to your attention that infighting and political finagling were ongoing. And this would continue throughout the next century, especially in Castile, where internal strife would dominate the scene. When we left off, Alfonso X, the wise, the learned, the writer, the founder of the great translating school of Toledo, sort of fumbled at the end of his reign when it came time to name a successor. It wasn't entirely his fault. His son, known as Fernando de la Cerda, had died prematurely, leaving the king without a male heir, or at least a direct one. So what were his options? One was his brother Sancho, who would have been king according to the Castilian law, and the other was his grandson Alfonso, that is Fernando's son, who according to Roman law was next in line. So depending on who you supported, their claim to the throne was better. To make a very long story short, Sancho wins out and becomes king until 1295. His reign is short and is one constant struggle to hold on to power, but he manages to do so. But he also dies rather young, and when he dies, his son, Fernando, is named king. He becomes Fernando IV. The problem is Fernando is also very young. He's age 9. So his mother, Maria de Molina, becomes the regent, but she too is faced with all sorts of challenges from other claimants to the throne. The going was very rough, and part of the problem was that her marriage to Sancho had not been approved by the Pope, at least yet, making all of her children officially illegitimate and thus ineligible to the throne. And another part of the problem was that several opponents never got over the fact Sancho became king and were just dying to look for any reason to get back into power. So this meant a whole slew of people came out of the woodwork and were vying to become the next king. Alfonso, his cousin, was one of them. Juan, his uncle. The king of Aragon, as well as the king of Portugal. Basically, everyone was vying for the post. Maria managed to keep the challengers at bay, and in 1301, her marriage to her dead husband was finally legitimized by the Pope, thus cementing Fernando's case. I will have to do another podcast about Maria de Molina, because she was an extraordinary woman at a time when men were dominating. A very interesting life. All the same, Fernando's reign wasn't that long either, especially once he got into power. And in September of 1312, when he was in Jaén and went to bed, they found him the next day dead at the age of 26. Now, considering all the rivals and enemies that he had, it certainly looks suspicious, but no one really knows for sure. And the best arguments actually point to some medical condition. In other words, it doesn't seem like he was the victim of foul play. He did leave a son, an heir, named Alfonso, who would become Alfonso XI. Now, the problem was, Alfonso was even younger than when Fernando became king. Remember, he was 9. This Alfonso was actually just 1 year old. So, as you can imagine, the gates were opened again for challengers to come forth, trying to snatch away the throne. By 1330 or so, Alfonso was able to confirm his position as king. During his reign, the first thing he had to do was grow up to be an age where he could rule, and then he consolidated his power. One of his aims at the time was actually to try and finish off the Muslim presence in the south of Spain, but that proved to be far more difficult than anyone could have imagined. His uncles had failed in a major campaign while he was still young, but he was able to push forward a little bit, especially near Algeciras in Cadiz. He wanted to take Gibraltar, but failed. All the same, he was slowly improving Castile's trade routes from the Atlantic to the Mediterranean. Alfonso also managed to massively improve Castile's foreign trade in the wool business. This would become one of the cornerstones of its economy for centuries, until the colonization of America brought wealth through precious metals. He was also seen as a man who put great emphasis on law and justice. He set up a legal code known as the Ordenamiento de Alcalá. Some of these laws and some of these statutes would stay into effect until the 19th century. Now, Alfonso's personal life would have a big impact on the future of Spain. As we have seen time and time again, monarchs often married young, often with the aim to ensure an heir, but they had no qualms about extramarital affairs, resulting in multiple children being born outside of wedlock. In Alfonso's case, his lover was a woman named Leonor de Guzman, or Eleanor de Guzman, and she was more than just a fling that produced a love child or two. This was basically his lifelong mistress, possibly the love of his life, but for a number of reasons, she would never be allowed to be the queen. Their relationship started before Alfonso married his second wife, Maria of Portugal, and it continued after their wedding, and pretty much for the rest of his life. In fact, once Alfonso produced an heir with Maria of Portugal, he essentially moved out and moved in with Leonor. This was, as you can imagine, as humiliating as you can get for Maria, and she would never forget it, as we will see in a second. Alfonso and Leonor actually ended up having somewhere, I think, 10 or 11 children. Alfonso lived until 1350, when he died of bubonic plague. Remember, that was the major epidemic that had come to Europe in 1348 and then began to spread throughout the rest of the continent, and it was decimating the population of all of those countries. And so we had to go on to the next king. Now, here's the thing. The main reason I was telling you about Alfonso and his mistress was not just to be gossipy, but to explain the events after he died, because the circumstances led to more future conflicts within the family, since Pedro, the rightful heir, the son of Maria, had to take on his half-brother Enrique, who was the son of Leonor. The two would unleash nearly 20 years of rivalry, and it would have a major impact on Castile. Now, why would this happen? Because you'd think, well, Pedro came from the legitimate marriage, so there really shouldn't be any question there. But there was a lot of rivalry between the two families, and there was a lot of power grabbing. The nobility got involved too. Some supported Enrique, others supported Pedro and his mother. Pedro sort of acquired a bad reputation for being especially cruel. I'm using that word because that's what he's sometimes known as. Not Pedro the First, Pedro the Cruel, especially merciless with his opponents, even after they surrendered. But another thing was that Maria of Portugal, Alfonso's wife and Pedro's mother, had the king's lover, Leonor, imprisoned and then executed. So she certainly hadn't forgotten being jilted all those years. And this was Enrique's mother, mind you, so tensions only got worse. The bitter fighting even spread between Pedro I and the King of Aragon, Pedro IV, resulting in a war known predictably as the War of the Two Pedros. And as I was telling you before, Pedro has gone down in history as Pedro the Cruel to his enemies and Pedro the Just to his supporters and followers. But mostly Pedro the Cruel, at least that's what people normally call him. And if you ask me, it's probably because it sounds more exciting from a morbid standpoint. It just sells better when talking about history. Anyway, this conflict went international, with mercenaries flocking in from other parts of Europe, which was also experiencing its own conflict known as the Hundred Years' War. Now, the most famous celebrity was the heir to the English throne, Edward, who is known in history as the Black Knight. And he backed Pedro, while a French commander, a very famous one and a very successful one, Bertrand de Guesclin, backed Enrique and the King of Aragon. And everyone sort of met at a battle known as the Battle of Nájera in Navarra in 1367. Pedro and Edward won that battle, but Enrique managed to escape. Edward, the Black Knight, left, abandoned Pedro for a couple of reasons. One, his forces were starting to die. They were suffering from dysentery. He was too. And apparently Pedro had reneged on his promise to pay the cost for the campaign. So all those reasons put together convinced Edward that it was time to leave. Enrique and Bertrand de Guesclin continued to push forward against Pedro. They met again in a town called Montiel, which is in La Mancha, and Pedro's forces lost. Now, Pedro was forced into the castle, and then he came out, and both Pedro and Enrique engaged in a dagger-to-dagger duel, which ended fatally for the king. Thanks to the treasonous help of Du Guesclin. I'm going to have to tell you about that story soon because it's pretty amazing. It's also the origin of a famous expression in Spain. Anyway, by murdering his half-brother, Enrique went down in history as Enrique the Fratricidal or Brother Killer. In return, he had one of his chroniclers describe the life of Pedro under the darkest of lights, dubbing him, as I mentioned before, Pedro the Cruel. It was an effective use of propaganda, as it has pretty much stuck to this day. Enrique also became the first monarch of the Trastamara dynasty to rule Castile. And why is that important? Well, for the next 150 years or so, this family will slowly lead the country, the Kingdom of Castile, into one of its most important periods in history. That is the completion of the Reconquista, is getting rid of the presence of the Moors, the Muslims, in Spain, or at least as an official territory. The Union of Aragon, which some consider to be when Spain united in an unofficial way, but it's you could argue that. And this family was also part of the discovery, or the European discovery, of America. So Enrique's rise to power was extremely important. Now, speaking of Aragon and the union with Aragon, Enrique would rule for 10 years until 1379, and then his son, Juan I, would take over until 1390, and that would be followed by Enrique III, who reigned into the early 15th century. Now, we just mentioned Aragon. Aragon is continuing to grow as a major presence in the northeast of Spain. The crown was looking for its own place in the world, with a struggling but powerful Castile to the west and the unyielding presence of the French to the north. It focused mainly on consolidating its position in the Mediterranean. Its biggest obstacles were the pirates from the north of Africa and the Genovese in Italy, their biggest trading competitors. Now, just a little reminder, if you recall, the setup of this kingdom is different from what many generally think. The capital is based in Zaragoza, which was the kingdom of Aragon, but this kingdom was basically united with Catalonia, which is the main economic motor of the land. When James I conquers Valencia, the city and the surrounding territories, a new kingdom, the Kingdom of Valencia, is created. It has its own laws, its own governing system, and even its own coins. And then when everyone sort of moves eastwards and they take the Balearic Islands, they create, that is, Mallorca, Menorca, and Ibiza, they create another kingdom called the Kingdom of Mallorca. So sort of this group of kingdoms and territories is what makes up the crown of Aragon. By 1300, business is booming for the Catalans. They are selling fabric and other products in exchange for spices. With those spices, then they'll sell them to the rest of Europe. These were, as we know, a very valuable commodity in those days. To improve their mercantile options, they continue to push mainly eastward to the islands of Corsica, Sardinia, and Sicily. As a result of this increase in trade, new institutions and business formats develop. These include the birth of banks and the creation of trade guilds, which on the outside look like a way of strengthening one sector, but in reality were very highly conservative and protectionist in their thinking. The biggest industry was most likely the textile producers. Valencia also slowly developed an important silk trade. The rise of the business class, the trades, the craftsmen, the guilds, and so on, meant the rise of a new class in society, and they would clash with the traditional power of feudal times, the nobility. The kings were the main ruling power, but their role was slightly different from the ones in Castile because they weren't as powerful as the others. And they often had to sort of come to agreements with the nobility and with the business class. And this was known as pactism. Many of the decisions are reached and executed in Catalonia. The king, Jaime II, who rules from 1285 to 1327, carries on a campaign to increase Aragon's control over the western part of the Mediterranean. He's the one who sort of consolidates Aragon's power in the Balearic Islands and starts to make some initial incursions into the Italian islands, into Sardinia and Corsica. It was also during this time that Aragon sent its much-feared Almogavar fighting force, a sort of a military company made up of mostly Catalan mercenaries, and they sent them to the Byzantine ruler over in Anatolia, Turkey, modern Turkey, to take on the Ottoman Empire. The next major ruler was Pedro IV, we just mentioned him before, whose reign lasted a very long time, 51 years. As we know, these were tough times. The Black Death was wreaking havoc, and the land was often decimated by drought. He also got involved in the Hundred Years' War, and also the war against Pedro I, as we know. That war didn't have a really clear victor, even though Pedro died, Pedro I, the cruel, but it would lead to a slow shift in Aragon's relationship with Castile, which up to that point had often been rather tense. Pedro was also able to reduce the influence of the Aragonese nobility, as we said, which was traditionally a sector you needed to sort of butter up when trying to assert your authority. After Pedro came John I, Juan I, who spent much of his reign struggling to stay in power. The wars waged turned out to be very costly. He also failed internationally, where Aragon was unable to conquer Sardinia despite years of trying, and they also lost their grip on Sicily. John would die after falling off a horse during a hunt. Unfortunately, all of his male descendants had died before he did, so his brother, Martin, took over. Martín was known as a humanist and a major supporter of the arts and humanities. He also founded a major library. He too ended up dying without any children to succeed him, and because of this, we will have a change in dynasties with important consequences. Martin's death spelled the end of the House of Barcelona as the dynasty, and now it is the Trastamara family, the same one that's taking over in Castile. This is important because it will facilitate the move towards a union between the two kingdoms down the road. But we still got a ways to go before we get to that point. And I've told you a lot today, so I think we'll stop there if that's all right with you. And we hope you've enjoyed this podcast by Brian Spain Domain. Please feel free to leave us with any comments because we love the feedback. You can subscribe to our podcast on Spotify, Amazon, Apple, and Castos. If you wish to support Brian Spain Domain, we'd greatly appreciate it. We've worked very hard to provide you with the best information about Spanish history and Spanish culture. If you wish to support Brian Spain Domain, please click on our PayPal donate button, or if you want to have access to absolutely all of our podcasts and support us on a regular basis, you can check us out at Patreon at the link provided below. Stay well, stay safe, and hasta pronto.